Welcome to the SF Squeecast, in which a group of science fiction and fantasy professionals squee about things SF-nal in a never-ending panel discussion of vague positivity. I'm Lynn Thomas, your moderator. Today, I am joined by Squeecast regulars Elizabeth Baer.
Hello.
Shauna McGuire.
Yeah.
And Catherine Valenti.
Hi.
Paul Cornell was unable to join us today. We are also pleased to welcome a special guest, Jim C. Hines.
Hello.
You may know him best as the writer of a series of books featuring princesses as Charlie's Angels, beginning with the stepsister scheme. His most recent novel is The Snow Queen's Shadow. Welcome, Jim.
Thank you.
This here is a very special Halloween-themed episode, so we're going to be talking about things that we like that are Halloween-related in one way, shape, or form. We hope that you enjoy it. Okay, Shauna is first going to talk to us about one of her favorite sets of films that are Halloween-related, the Halloween Town films. The first one came out in 1998, the last one came out in 2006, and there are four of them. Shauna,
no,
what
there
are you...
Are.
No?
There are only three of them.
Okay.
I don't know what world you live in where there was a fourth Halloween Town movie made with a replacement for the original actress and with a script that completely diverged from initial continuity. I don't live in that world.
I see. Okay, I must have gotten the Wikipedia information from the alternate world version. Sorry. There are three Halloween Town films.
There are three Halloween Town films. The main reason I say that is that this is the Vague Positivity Squeecast, and my friends have found that mentioning that there might have been a sequel to Halloween Town High is a really good way to watch me go into a rant that is normally triggered only by people saying things like, Tamlin is a sweet romance. In the Halloween Town movies, Marnie Piper finds out that the reason her mother's always been so opposed to Halloween, while she and her siblings have always been very drawn to it, is because her mom's actually from Halloween. It's kind of the Nightmare Before Christmas setup in that Halloween and all of the monsters and the ghosts and the magic and all of that live in their own little sub-dimension. And it's kind of a Disney Channel original movie in that everyone is, you know, very cheaply animated, if animated at all. It's mostly real people. It's a surprisingly good series. The scripts are interesting enough that even my adult friends are willing to watch them with me. I don't count myself as an adult where Disney Channel programming is concerned because I don't fit any demographic. But I can go, hey, Chris, we're going to watch Halloween Town. And rather than throwing stuff at my head, he says, okay, Halloween Town again. It's got a good set of messages, but they're not message movies. They're movies about going to Halloween and having a good time. And the first ones, at least, were very clearly made by people that genuinely loved the subject material. The first movie was Halloween Town. You know, as you said, it came out in 1998. And the girl who played Marnie Piper, Kimberly J. Brown, the only other thing you may have seen her in was the Rose Red miniseries that was made for TV. But she's great. She's a Disney Channel heroine who's not skinny. She's not fat either, but she's built like a kid that you would believe can control a broom. You know, she's a real-shaped girl, which is lovely and makes it much easier to watch this with my nieces without worrying about eating disorders. The second one was made about 3 years later. I think it was one of the very first ever Disney Channel sequels. And so they worked way harder on it than they have on some of the more recent sequels. They actually picked up the story from the original movie. They had all the same characters. They had all the same actors. And they really just continued it. And they rocked with their concept. Halloween Town High, which is the third one, is a little bit of a fall off. I was really excited about it, but it was not as solid as the first two. Then again, they still had the original actors. They still had a lot of the original scriptwriters. They still had a good time. And at least up until that point, they had Debbie Reynolds playing Marnie's grandmother and the head witch of Halloween Town, which how can you go wrong with Debbie Reynolds being like, hello, I have magical powers. And by the way, you're a rock. Random dancer team. What? Guys, come on.
Hello. I was in a Debbie Reynolds happy place, actually.
Okay, good.
I haven't seen these, but my visual imagination kicked in for a moment there, and it was good. It was really good.
Debbie Reynolds is a happy place.
Yes.
Especially when she's kicking ass.
Oh, yes. And she kicks a lot of ass as Aggie Pike. She really, really does. Agatha Cromwell, sorry.
I've seen the first one, and I think I have seen the alternate dimension one that doesn't exist in this world.
So bad!
It's the one that has the kid from High School Musical in it, right?
which kid from High School Musical? Lucas Grabeel?
Yes.
He's actually in the second and third, too. Oh,
okay, then I've seen either the second or the third, but the fourth one clearly still doesn't exist. So
that is correct.
Yeah, these are really fun. We watch these with Caitlin. You know, Disney Channel, bless their hearts, they go all out for Halloween. They have lots and lots of Halloween-themed programming. But these are really fun. And one of the things I really like about them is that they're just sort of matter-of-fact about everything. It's just like, oh, yeah, you know, your great uncle's a werewolf, and you know, you had a grandmother who was a witch, and now you're going to go to the academy and learn a little bit about witchcraft, and, oh, by the way, you have to save the world. Have fun with that. And, you know, there's the ticking clock of the portal that is only open on Halloween and closes at midnight, so things move along plot-wise. They're great fun, and everybody looks like they're having a really good time. It's very family-oriented, but not in a hokey kind of way, which is always refreshing. I think there's a little bit of an edge there in terms of particularly the tension in the relationship between the grandmother, the mom, and the daughter, because you've got this sort of triangle where they're sort of pushing and pulling because mom doesn't want the daughter to become a witch and part of Halloween Town, and the daughter wants to hang out with grandma more, and grandma wants the daughter and the mom. I mean, the granddaughter and the mom to come back and be part of Halloween Town. So there's this wonderful tension that drives the whole series of these three generations of women who they themselves are the ones driving the plots, basically. And that's also really, really nice. It's not a standing around waiting for, you know, boys to do stuff. So I really enjoy it.
Nicely timed coughing fit, Jim.
Yeah.
Thank you. I'm trying.
You're doing real well. And, you know, I apologize for...
Hmm? Halloween Town just gets me so choked up.
I would apologize for bringing more kid stuff to the Squeecast, except for the part where it's me, so your other options involve Halloween-themed serial killers, and I'm nicer than that.
Nicer than the serial killers?
I'm nicer than making all y'all listen to how giddy I get when I talk about them.
Shannon?
Yes?
I'm in this Squeecast, too.
Did you bring a serial killer?
Actually, yes.
Yay!
But anytime you want to be inappropriately giddy about serial killers, I'm your girl.
Yeah. Yay! Can you come over? Yeah. You have to see Contagion with me. It's the romantic comedy of the season.
You know, Elizabeth and I conveniently live on the same coast. You got to come out here.
Be there this evening.
It is the romantic story of a virus and its love for your lungs.
Aww.
That sounds so sweet. I'm all choked up.
That's the virus.
Oh, dear.
And I say this in full recognition of how deeply nerdy it is. Does it get Madagascar?
Of course it gets Madagascar.
Yay!
I stayed awake for 36 hours to get Madagascar. For those who may require a footnote, a Flash-based internet game called Pandemic 2 featured a great variety of ways to destroy mankind, all of which we exploited while giggling like idiots. Unfortunately, Madagascar had an unfortunate tendency to close its borders just as everyone else started dying, which made a lot of us want to go stand on the Madagascar border with canisters and slingshots.
that last epidemiologist in Iceland who would not die. That guy or girl
would not die.
But one person in Iceland is still working on a cure.
But then he dies.
Yes. And Madagascar still has closed borders, so you don't win. The object of the game is to wipe out humanity.
It's so much fun.
Sean and I may not be on the rest of y'all's side.
I'll keep that in mind. Okay.
Not news.
Not news. Bear has brought to us A Night in the Lonesome October by Roger Zelazny. This was published in 1993. It was his last published book, according to the Great God Wikipedia, and it was nominated for the Nebula for Best Novel in 1994. Bear, why don't you tell us about it?
I should actually mention that it's by Roger Zelazny, illustrated by Gahan Wilson, so it's even cooler than that. A Night in the Lonesome October is one of the late and funny Zelazny's when he, at a certain point in his career, Roger Zelazny seems to have stopped taking everything so seriously and started writing things like Bring Me the Head of Prince Charming and A Night in the Lonesome October. A Night in the Lonesome October is written in 31 chapters. Each chapter is a day in October, starting on the 1st, ending on the 31st. It takes place in the Victorian period, and the narrator and protagonist is a dog. The dog's name is Snuff. The dog is a watchdog. He also spends a lot of time walking around Whitechapel with his owner, whose name is Jack. Are you with me so far? Other...
Oh, dear.
Yeah, oh, the penny just dropped. I did say I was bringing you a serial killer. Snuff is a very good dog, and it turns out that he's not actually just a dog and a watchdog. He's also an occult familiar. And over the course of the novel, he engages with a lot of other familiars who work for people like the Count and the Good Doctor and a gentleman who has a consulting detective agency, and a werewolf, and a mad monk. And anyway, it turns out that what's going on is that all of these people are arrayed on one side or the other of a great conspiracy that every time there's a full moon on Halloween, attempts to, they either belong to the openers or the closers. The openers are attempting to open a gate. The closers are attempting to keep the gate closed. What's on the other side of the gate is Lovecraftian reality. Meanwhile, we're following this dog around his daily routine as Jack the Ripper's pet. I don't know how to express adequately how wonderful this book is. One of the funniest parts of it is Snuff's relationship with the other animals he meets, because they engage in very typical animal behavior, but they do it with this very Victorian reserved sensibility. So at one point, Snuff is talking to a graveyard dog, and the conversation goes something like, "And now I will show you my teeth. Will you show me your teeth?" It's just, it's deeply fabulous and deeply weird. The only thing I can think of that really compares with it for sort of lampooning Victorian morality is Joe Walton's Dragon Book, the title of which eludes me at the moment.
Tooth and Claw.
Thank you. It's got that kind of alienation of human culture by showing it through the eyes of a dog who happens to work for a psychopathic killer who may be one of the good guys, depending on what your definition of good guy is. Anyway, I recommend this book to everyone. It's a very quick read. It's actually reasonably suitable for not very young children. I wouldn't read it to a six-year-old. And it's one of the great Halloween books of all time, as far as I'm concerned.
If I actually read this, my brother will owe you money. He's been trying to get me to read Zelazny for 7 years. So I may need an address where he can send the check.
Well, as long as you're selective about it, I recommend Zelazny. He's actually very good at rubbing words together. And in his earlier novels, sometimes you have to deal with gender and cultural artifacts of the era. But in terms of world building and plot and character and the way he uses white space in a story, you know, I still use some of his tricks to teach my students. The man was actually quite good at his job.
So I read Night of the Lonesome October. Interestingly enough, I read it for the science fiction and fantasy book club that I started on my island because I didn't want to read the kinds of books that the regular book club was reading. The odd thing about that book club is that I and my husband were the only people who had ever read science fiction and fantasy before. So it was a very educational experience. And this was, we read it last October. And this was one of the ones that I brought that sort of turned my head around as to how people who aren't regular readers of science fiction fantasy read books, because they had no idea what the book was about. Like, one of them said, "I think Sherlock Holmes was in it." They really could not. It is such an insider's book. It is so full of inside genre jokes that it's almost impenetrable to the outside reader. But oddly enough, the response of every single person in the group, including myself, was, "Well, I guess it was all right." It was cute, but did not excite any strong emotions in any of us. That is kind of where I was at. I love Snuff, but the book didn't really, it was neither here nor there for me. On the other hand, the daughter of one of the book club participants who was 12 absolutely adored it. So I do think it's appropriate for older children. It's got a very YA sensibility about it. I think if it were published now, it would definitely be YA. But I think it's all right.
That's interesting. I think a good deal of the joy of the book for me is the game. And I agree with Kat that it is very much an insider's book. And it's very much about the science fictional of, oh, figuring out that this guy is Victor Frankenstein is important. You know, it's where the pleasure and the narrative comes from.
Right. And when people don't, I mean, this group of people did not actually know who Lovecraft was. So,
right.
I mean, it was completely lost. Any of that figuring out sort of pleasure was completely lost on them. Whereas for me, because I know all that stuff backwards and forwards, it didn't quite do anything for me because I caught on to it too quickly. So I think you need to find the reader that's in that sweet spot of genre know-how, which often means teenagers. And I think it's a great book for teenagers.
And I think I read it when it first came out, so I would have been in my very early 20s, which may have influenced my love for it. I don't know, coming at it as a 40-year-old, how I would feel about it.
Oh, I mean, half of my friends pressured me to read this book long before I ever actually did read it. It is very beloved among science fiction readers.
Okay.
And remains the only Zelazny I've read, actually.
That's such an interesting generational thing, because I've noticed that people my age and older have read a ton of Zelazny, and then you drop back a few years.
Yeah,
and,
absolutely. I've noticed.
Yeah, and there's just this hard line. It's really interesting to me.
Do you have any notion as to why that might be?
I think that once he died, a lot of his books fell out of print, and I think a lot of people stopped talking about them. So people have this idea that all he wrote was the Amber novels. Also, the later Amber novels were frankly not all that great. And I think if you came to them, came to his work in the terms of those last five book, you walk away with a different impression of the man than if you started off with either the first two or three Amber novels or something like Roadmarks. I also think that some of his work that was considered really great, like Lord of Light, has not aged particularly well.
You're also, I think, going to get a certain element of the what's new and shiny and the covers. You know, Stephen King's oldest work is still being read, but that's partially because they reprint him with market-appropriate covers every 5 to 6 years.
Mm-hmm.
I know a lot of people who did not read James Tiptree, not because they didn't have access. Those books were in my library. They could get to them. They were friends of mine. But because when they looked at the books, what they saw was not something that was worth reading to them. It wasn't until Her Smoke Rose Up Forever, which was a recent collection of Tiptree stories, and had a very modern cover, and had a cover that said to their heads, hey, this is something that is still topical, that people read that book and then came to me and said, hey, do you have Star Songs of an Old Primate? Can I borrow 10,000 Light Years from Home?
Yep.
Oh,
those 70s covers.
Yeah, he's been aged out by his covers and by no one wants to read what mom says is cool.
We're going to turn now to TV. It is not Halloween in many households until certain things are consumed, and one of them may well be what Jim is bringing to the table today, which is episode 6 of season 2 of Buffy the Vampire Slayer, appropriately entitled Halloween. Jim?
Yep. Okay. And just to start with a general disclaimer, you know, Buffy as a whole, I loved this series. It had some flaws. It wasn't perfect, but I loved the idea. I loved the stories. I loved the dialogue. And just to step back for a moment, I don't know if this audience needs to have Buffy explained, but in brief, you've got a girl named Buffy, and she slays vampires, and there you have Buffy the Vampire Slayer. The Halloween episode, it opens with our gang. Buffy and Xander and Willow are in high school, and they get rounded up by the principal and told, you will go forth and escort these little kids around on Halloween. Because, you know, the principal thinks that they're troublemakers because they're always running off and slaying things. So our trio gets stuck doing the escort thing. They go out. They get their costumes, and then we get the magic, because the costumes become the person. Willow dresses up as a ghost and is suddenly walking through walls. Xander dresses up as a soldier and becomes Mr. Macho Testosterone Soldier Dude. Buffy has dressed up in this 17th or 18th century gown in an attempt to impress her vampire boyfriend. And so goes from being the Slayer to being this sort of over-the-top, helpless damsel, which is entertaining. But I was much more into watching Xander, watching Willow, and some of the other characters that we get throughout this story. Starting with Spike, actually. Spike has been on a mission. He's another vampire, pops up planning to kill the Slayer. I remember seeing this episode for the first time. And, you know, it's not just these three that the costumes are taking over. All of the kids who dressed up as goblins are now running around as goblins or as giant dog monsters or whatever. And Spike goes strolling down the street, looking at all this chaos, listening to the screaming, looking at all the panic. And he says, this is just neat. Just this sort of perfect encapsulation of his character, that he's playful, he's fun, he enjoys this, and he is unapologetically evil. And that one line, there we go. This is Spike. He is my new favorite vampire. Over the course of the episode, we get some revelations about a few other characters. You have Giles, who is the proper librarian watcher who trains Buffy the Slayer. And basically, he's kind of the librarian cliche. He stays in his library. He's very busy in his books. He's very sort of withdrawn and proper and all of that. And for the first time, we run into somebody from Giles's past. You know, the bad guy who is casting our costume spell, in fact, is someone that knows Giles and greets him by the name Ripper. Which also, we have the nice thematic thing going back to Bear's book. And Giles, this proper, uptight librarian person, removes his glasses and proceeds to kick the crap out of the bad guy, which is something that you've never seen Giles do before. So we're getting revelation into him. We've got Spike. And more than anything, we've got all of the typical high school angst. We've got the sort of petty politics of high school that we all remember oh so well. But we also get that essence of Halloween, of dressing up and really becoming somebody else, which this is what science fiction and fantasy does. We take these things, we make them literal, and we run with it. In the end, it's a self-contained episode. We deal with the monsters. We end the curse in the nick of time. Buffy beats up the vampire. But overall, it's a wonderful little slice of Buffiness, and I would highly recommend it for that.
One of the things that I really loved about that episode was Xander's character development through it. As for, I think, pretty much the first time in the series, we see him claim some power.
And he gets to keep it. They come back.
Except he doesn't really, because they keep dropping that continuity, which was one of the things that frustrated me. But
yeah, different writers. Normally, you get a show and they were possessed, and then they wake up and they have no memory whatsoever. In this one, they held on to that. And in at least some of the later episodes, Xander still has his macho army dude thing going on.
Which has really interesting implications that were never really followed up on, because did everybody retain some of what they had? Because that makes Sunnydale a much more interesting place with all those kids.
It might explain why suddenly everyone else in the school was willing to move on later and do things like give Buffy the Protector of the Class Award. If you remember being a monster for a night, that makes it so much harder to pretend it was a bear on PCP.
Well, and the notion of holding on to things that happen and not being allowed to forget them is something that even happened in season one with the episode The Pack. After Xander claims a different kind of power and basically turns into a jackass bully for an episode, you know, at the very end, only Giles knows that he remembers what he did, but he remembers. And he has to live with that and try to rebuild those friendships again.
Yeah, that's very true.
I think it's one of the things that, at least sometimes, that show did well, is the idea that even in the more self-contained episodes, there are consequences. And you're going to have to live with those.
Absolutely. Of course, this is sort of the beginning of the flowering of my fascination with Giles. I know, what a shock. Lynn likes the librarian.
Everybody likes the librarian.
Yeah. Giles is like, I mean, we put Giles on the cover of American Libraries, our professional magazine, because we love him so much. And this episode is actually one of the reasons that we do, because the whole, I was a badass once and I can totally kick yours anytime I feel like it, but I'm choosing not to because I'm going to be proper. That's so hot. We love that. There was at one point, I think, a tease that there might be a Ripper series or a comic or a mini series or something telling us that backstory between Giles and Ethan Rain. And I still would love to see that. That's the story that I just wish would be told, because I just find all of that fascinating and, well, you know, hot, because it's Giles.
I was actually looking that up last night as I was preparing for this, because I would love to see that too. And it sounds like it went from being a series to being a mini series to being a made-for-TV movie to being, oh, sorry, Joss is busy doing Dollhouse, and now he's doing... And the last thing I heard is it's not completely off the table, but Mr. Whedon keeps getting caught up in other things.
Yeah, and right now, Tony Head, who played Giles, is actually on one of the new TV series this season, the one with Hank Azaria. It's the one about divorced people in an office. I can't remember. I've been seeing the promo. But he's on that. So he actually has a recurring gig on that show. I don't know if that would also influence the ability for him to work with Joss for a limited amount of time. Of course, I was also all for Giles, Faith, and Spike on motorcycles save the world. I want to see that, too.
See, I want the Giles and Oz road movie.
Yes! That would be awesome.
As far as speaking of series that have a different runtime in my reality than the outside reality, as far as I was concerned, Buffy pretty much ended when Giles and Oz were gone. So
that's early on.
Yeah. Well, you know, I don't think that season 6 of Xena happened, so, you know, it's all fair.
It didn't. It totally didn't.
No. I'm not really sure that season 6, except for the musical, happened of Buffy. So.
Oh, no. Come on. I mean, I will defend season 6, except for the magic arc. I actually think season 6 is a pretty great season of Buffy. And the magic arc actually is only 3 or 4 episodes when you add it up.
Yeah.
And I mean, I think that there are things in season 6 that very few other genre shows even try to tackle about superheroes and the reality of being one. Yes, we get the upsetting Giles gets paid and Buffy doesn't women's work theme, but there's a lot going on there with Buffy and Spike, with just the horror of everyday life, and as well as the what is the asylum episode? I can't remember the name of it. Yeah, the traditional science fiction television show. Mm-hmm. It's all just the mad ravings of a lunatic in an asylum episode, whatever it was called. It's a great episode, and I really like the finale of that season. I think that season 6 is actually one of my favorite seasons. I just don't watch the stupid Willow magic arc episode.
Okay,
it's either wholesome lesbian sex or it's crap. Like, you can't fix your medicine.
You can't have both.
Oh, goodness. Oh,
I love you guys.
Minor note from Wikipedia. Apparently, this episode, Halloween, is one of the most popular for fanfickers, particularly crossovers, because of all of the costume choices. There you go.
And all of the costume possibilities.
Yes, and I would argue also the slash possibilities, because
between Ethan Rain and Ethan Rain sort of slashes with everyone.
Oh, yeah, totally.
One of the coolest points of my entire writing career was when Lightspeed Magazine somehow managed to hire the actor who played Ethan Rain to read my How to Become a Mars Overlord story. And I clicked play, and Ethan Rain's voice said my name in his own words, in his own mouth. It was amazing.
It was really awesome.
Kat, you're such a nerd.
I am. So what?
I love
my podcast, dude.
And the rest of us so aren't.
Yeah.
It's my highest compliment. So, although, and Kat, I have to say that, having said, oh my God, you're such a nerd, I had a minor nerdgasm over having a story narrated by Gates McFadden. So
awesome.
I'm right there with you.
Yeah. It's basically pretty awesome all the way around, frankly. So, you know, it's, yeah.
Yeah.
Kat wanted to talk about the video game Costume Quest. Kat?
So this is actually incredibly thematically appropriate to the Buffy episode, which I'll get to in a minute. Costume Quest is a downloadable game for Xbox 360 and PS3. It is a short game. It is one of the best video games I've ever played. The animation is great. The writing is truly funny and spectacular. And it is all things Halloween rolled up into a playable package. The plot of Costume Quest is that you have a pair of identical twins, Reynold and Ren, And you can choose whether to play as the little boy or the little girl. I have no idea what the game looks like if you play as the little boy. I think that should be obvious what my choice would be. I played as Ren. And whichever one you choose is dressed up as a robot for Halloween, and the other sibling is a piece of candy corn. Obviously, as a nod to Sean and Maguire. And the plot begins as a monster who will turn out to be an alien eventually and requires candy to survive kidnaps the sibling dressed up as a candy corn in order to eat him as a very large piece of candy, and the sister, Ren, has to rescue him. The gameplay comes when whatever you are dressed up as, that is what you become when battles commence. So the little girl dressed up as a robot becomes a gigantic transformer. When she gets a cardboard medieval knight costume with a wooden sword, she turns into a giant crusader knight. You collect pieces of the costumes throughout the game. Whenever you get a new costume, you have a new set of battle activities that you can do. One of the most powerful costumes in the game is the sparkly unicorn rainbow pony who kicks all kinds of ass. It is, as I said, truly funny. The writing is very clever and genuinely emotionally involving. It's also one of the most feminist games I've ever played. Your Ren gets teamed up with her friend from school, who's a little boy, and who is black as well. So we have like multiracial and multigender protagonists in this game. It's great. But he's very, very smart. And I was all ready for this game to be the girl is dumb and likes to hit things and the boy is smart. But then you get a third member to your party, and it's a girl scientist from their same third grade class. You go from door to door trick-or-treating, and at some of the doors you have grubbins, which are the alien goblin things who attack you, and at some of them it's just people who give you candy. And the candy graphic, it's a huge torrent of candy with a song like manna falling from heaven glittering down your screen in this huge waterfall of sugary goodness. It's exactly what candy seemed to be like when you were a kid. And at one point, when you're at one of the levels, a man answers the door. He's dressed up as a cowboy, and he says, "Here, take an extra helping. My husband always buys too much candy." And I almost cried. I could not believe that actually happened. I was just totally blown away. There are three main worlds. They are all just gorgeously, exactly the way you remember Halloween being. The first one is your neighborhood, and all the leaves are rolling down the street, and there you have apple dunking mini games, and there's the actual whistle of the wind is in the game. And the second level is the mall, where you have all of the sort of traditional mall activities for Halloween as mini games. And the third level is this combination of New England and like the English countryside, this rural trick-or-treating neighborhood with stone houses and, you know, jack-o'-lanterns everywhere. And it is just so Halloweenish and wonderful. And you get to save your little brother. And at no point does anything offend me or upset me in this game. And I can only complain that it's over too quickly, although they did just release a new chapter of it that takes place during winter. So I'm looking forward to playing that.
That sounds like the best game ever.
It is the best game ever.
Is this an Xbox game, or what's the platform?
Yeah, it's downloadable, and so it's on Xbox and PS3. I mean, it's not even, I think it's like 1,200 Microsoft points or something. It supplies so much joy for so little investment. I just, whenever I think about the game, I smile, because everything I love about Halloween is just in this game, where you actually turn into your costume is so cool, especially the first time that the piece of crap plastic bag that you uses a ghost costume turns into this huge, enormous, crazy, battle-hardened thing. It's just so delightful.
This game is relevant to my interests.
I thought about you when I played it, and I am you. I was like, "Sean, you have to play this game." And I think Sean would really, really like it, especially, of course, when you get the unicorn sparkle magical rainbow pony final weapon.
As I now know that you have an Xbox, I will be picking up my pre-order of Lollipop Chainsaw. And I'm not kidding. That's a real game. It's by James Gunn, who needs to call me, and I'm going to come over, and we're going to play Costume Quest and Lollipop Chainsaw till we both puke.
This game was actually done by the people who did Brutal Legend. And
awesome!
They did the Psychonauts game as well. So this is a company with some serious cred behind it. And this was actually developed while they thought they had a contract for a sequel to Brutal Legend, and in fact did not. So they would break off into groups and just come up with dumb ideas for games. And this was one they actually developed. I mean, I just can't say enough good things about it. I think it's fantastic. And it's totally appropriate for kids. I think adults would get a huge kick out of the cleverness and humor. I don't want to say that it's kind, because that makes it sound like it's not hardcore and awesome, but it is. But the humor is not at anybody's expense. It's just funny and clever. Portal was funny and clever, but it's all making fun of the player, which is hilarious. This is just a wry, funny, sarcastic girl hero of the kind that we all know and love. She could easily grow up to be a heroine in one of Sean's novels.
And would eat all your Halloween candy.
Our final topic before we ask Jim lots of silly questions to put him on the spot is mine. And as soon as we decided we were doing a Halloween episode, I claimed this because this is my favorite part, and Halloween isn't Halloween until I watch this, which is It's the Great Pumpkin, Charlie Brown. It originally was broadcast in 1966. It's been played in reruns since then, pretty much annually. We own it on DVD. It is, for me, the quintessence of the Charlie Brown holiday experience. As much as I love the Charlie Brown Christmas, Great Pumpkin is really my absolute favorite, mostly because it's all about Linus. You know, I love Charlie Brown, but Linus is after my own heart, and I have to sort of sheepishly admit that Linus in Great Pumpkin kind of reminds me of my husband. We have a sort of Sally and Linus thing going on occasion, and so we sit there and smirk at each other as we watch this, because it's like, I have such deep affection for this, and as much as this doesn't specifically qualify as science fiction in a narrow sense, because of Snoopy's World War I Flying Ace adventure, I'm saying that counts as science fiction, because he's down behind enemy lines and having a grand old time, and then a good laugh and a good cry when he gets to the party. And I love this so, so hard. I wanted us to talk about it, because it's like my favorite thing ever. Every year I swear that I'm going to put out a sign in the front yard that says, "Welcome, Great Pumpkin," and every year I never get around to it. One of these years it's going to happen.
And it better be this year.
Yeah, clearly.
I'm holding you to that.
Okay. All right. I will find a way to make a sign that says, "Welcome, Great Pumpkin," that goes in the front yard. It needs to happen. I love the notion of the sincerest pumpkin in the pumpkin patch, and the sincerest pumpkin patch in all the land. That is something that just appeals to me so, so deeply. And I just love it to pieces.
Well, it's sort of a wonderful validation of nerdity, isn't it? Because one of the things about nerds is that we're sincere about liking stuff. We're not hip. We're not cool. We like stuff. And sincerity is a very nerdy thing to have. We don't like things ironically. We just like things. So if you really like pumpkins, I think that's science fictional all by itself. Come on, guys. Help me out here. I'm dying.
It turns out that if you paint yourself orange with black glow paint and hide behind the larger pumpkins in a pumpkin patch when you know that the elementary school hayride is coming through, and jump out screaming "Blood for the Great Pumpkin," their reaction is very science fictional.
Why do I have a sense that this is not, in fact, a hypothetical knowledge on your part?
There are a couple pumpkin patches I've been banned from.
Got him. Are banned from more pumpkin patches than any other science fiction writer.
Oh, I'm also mayor of more pumpkin patches than any other science fiction writer, so it's kind of a thing. I'm official mayor of 17 pumpkin patches right now, some of which I've never been to. They just email me and tell me. I love the Great Pumpkin. He is the foundation of my personal, somewhat weird religious beliefs, which hold that if you believe in something well enough, it will take care of you. I've seen that special hundreds upon hundreds of times. Not exaggerating, I had depression issues when I was a teenager, and that was one of the things I just put on continuous loop for entire weekends if I was having a problem. So I will love it forever unconditionally. I'm not even vaguely positive about it. It got me through some really hard times, because as Bear says, anything that we are completely sincerely in love with is fanish and is capable of doing what the Great Pumpkin does, which is all you have to do is be faithful and wait in the sincerest pumpkin patch in the land, and you're going to get some candy.
And meet your God, who will descend.
Meet my God!
Who will descend from the dark heavens. And this is getting a little Lovecraftian.
It's entirely possible that my God has to be watered with the blood of the innocent. Hey, Jim, can I borrow your kids?
What makes you think Jim's kids are innocent?
Let me check and see whether they've done their chores this weekend, and then we'll decide.
Okay.
my grandmother and my grandfather too, to a lesser extent, but my grandmother was obsessed with the Peanuts, and so I certainly was watching that from a very young age. She's passed away now, so I very much associate that special and most Peanuts things with afternoons at my grandmother's house. And she lived on a canal in Washington, in the Seattle area, and I very much remember the sort of autumn willow that she had chopping its leaves onto the water while I was watching the Great Pumpkin special, and it's a very fond thing for me as well.
Well, Peanuts in general is just awesome. All of the characters. I grew up on Peanuts. Snoopy is my muse. I love Sphinx. Oh, you think I'm joking?
No. That was a laugh
no.
recognition.
Straying away from the Halloween episode, Snoopy as a writer is like, oh my God, yes, you get it. You know, to this day, I cannot let a Halloween go without going up to somebody and saying, I got a rock.
Are you kidding? We do that in everyday life. I do that at conventions and conferences. Like, you know, I'll go through the dealer room at ALA and come out and be like, I got a rock.
We messed that up one year by taking my rock tumbler and a bunch of geodes and actually making really pretty rocks and letting kids pick their own from the bowl, which was wonderful because we had just swarms of children running down the driveway shouting, Mommy, Mommy, I got a rock! Their parents just like, what the hell are the weird people doing?
That's like 50 years later. It's the redemption of Charlie Brown.
Well, maybe he went on to a jewelry making business. You know, he just took all those rocks he got for Halloween and tumbled them into something beautiful and made jewelry. He's got his own Etsy store right now, I'm sure of it.
Oh, I was just going to say, thinking about all of the things that Charlie Brown goes through and all of the things that the other kids say and do to him, he might have found another use for those rocks.
This is true.
Yeah, I find that I can watch the Halloween special much more easily than I can watch the Christmas special, which just really upsets me. Much as the music is sense memory of childhood Christmas, the actual Charlie Brown Christmas special upsets me so deeply because of how they treat Charlie Brown. Charlie Brown is always treated badly, but the Christmas special is a special circumstance. My brother, one of my brothers, was born with a perfectly round head. We don't know why. He was not delivered by C-section, but has received Charlie Brown gifts from the age of zero, and he's 26 and he still gets them, and Charlie Brown sweaters and everything else. So we had someone in my family who identified very strongly with Charlie Brown, and the Christmas special was always a source of many tears.
See, I can understand that, but for our household, I think we have less difficulty with the Christmas special merely because of what a dick Santa is in Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. Like, re-watching that, you know, I grew up watching that and thinking it was great, and then I sat down to watch it with my kid when she was like five, and I was like, wow, Santa's kind of a dick. Why is he being so mean?
Santa,
because
like
Rudolph is radioactive.
Yeah. No, because Santa, like Superman, is a dick.
Yeah, clearly. This is why we need the Batman to keep them in line.
Now I'm picturing Batman with a long white beard, and it's troubling me.
Oh, goodness. Do we have anything else we want to say about Great Pumpkin? Okay.
I'm sorry. I'm womanly resisting making Robin Rudolph jokes.
That is very brave of you, Bear. The final thing that we do is a segment where we ask our guest a bunch of questions, and Shannon gets out of it yet again because we have a guest this week. So, Jim, see, now that's an evil laugh. I'm going to have to practice. So, Jim, the first question comes from Paul. He would like to know, what do you most fear?
Shannon McGuire with a fully stocked microbiology lab.
Okay.
I like you.
There was a serious answer that I fear that the book I'm working on right now will suck. And, I mean, it doesn't even matter what book I'm working on. It's going to suck. I've lost it. Da-da-da. But mostly the nightmares come from the idea of Shannon in a lab coat hanging out at the lab going, ooh, let's see what these viruses do.
Oh, I may have nightmares.
What happens when we splice in the Klingon DNA?
Okay, Shauna would like to know, can I have a cookie?
Yes, she can have a cookie. But if she touches my cheesecake, then we're going to throw down.
Cheesecake is icky.
Whatever. Just fine.
Okay. Shauna would also like to know, what's the first book you remember reading on your own initiative?
Now, see, that gets tricky because with my memory, it could be the thing that I read last week is the first one I actually remember. Thinking back, my parents had this whole set of bookshelves in the basement, and what I could reach were all the little comic compilations, the collections of Peanuts and Beetle Bailey and Garfield and Heathcliff. And I remember running down there and getting one of these comic books and just hanging out in the basement in the old chair that smelled vaguely like cat piss and reading these old comics. And then as I got older, I would start to get into things like the Great Brain series and Bunnicula. And I went through most of the Little House on the Prairie books. But I think the first stuff that I was seeking out and reading were Snoopy collections and the like.
Paul would like to know, what have you done today to make him feel proud?
Okay, I had to think about this one because I don't know Paul. I don't know what sort of things would make him proud. So in the end, I decided it was just easier to build a machine that would control his emotions. And thus, I created the Make Paul Proudinator. And I'm just going to turn that on here in a second. And I probably should not have put the self-destruct button so close to the on switch.
So, you know, Jim, you just made me proud.
Aww.
As a follow-up, Bear would like to know, since you did put the self-destruct button awfully close, what do you want on your tombstone?
If all goes according to plan, I would like to live forever. So maybe like just a sign that says this space for Ren.
Okay. Bear would like to know, what is your favorite joke? And you can feel free to actually tell us your favorite joke.
Except that I can't because it won't work that way. Because my favorite joke comes from my son several years ago. He was right at that age where he was starting to grasp the concept of jokes, but wasn't all the way yet. So we had told him the knock-knock joke of knock-knock. Oh, we'll do it this. Knock-knock.
Who's there?
Who's there?
Thank you. Banana.
Banana who?
We've got the chorus going. Good. And then we go knock-knock, banana, knock-knock, banana. And finally go with orange. Orange who? Aren't you glad
I didn't say banana?
Yeah.
Right. So my son shows up at the dinner table one night, and he's just all excited, and he goes, Daddy, Daddy, knock, knock. Who's there? Banana orange. And he was just so proud of himself. And it was so much funnier watching him tell this joke than any regular knock, knock joke. So yes, that would be my favorite joke. Banana orange.
Kat would like to know, what is your quest?
My quest is to make it through the rest of this podcast without making a complete fool of myself any more than I may have already done.
I'd like to know, what is your favorite guilty pleasure?
But, see, that was another one that I looked at in a slide. I prefer my pleasure to be guilt-free, so I don't know how to answer that one.
Okay. Do you have a favorite word?
Platypus.
Platypus. That's all the questions we have. Okay, so that's all for the Squeecast this week. Thanks for joining us. Thanks to our regular contributors, Sean and Kat and Bear, and our guest, Jim C. Hine. Special thanks to our webmaster, Dmitry Zagadulin, our technical producer, Carol Brown, Jeff Bonoff at Mystic Fig Studios for the instrumentals of music by Sean and McGuire, Katie Shuttleworth, who made our rockin' logo, and Michael D. Thomas for general administrative support. We hope that you will join us next time. Same Squee time, same Squee channel.